This is a Deese World production in association with Pants Pending Studios.
My big sister and I are so excited to introduce our new podcast to you. Trading Pages is a wonderful
podcast. Tradingpages.pantspending.com.
Hold on, I'm not there yet. A podcast where two sisters sit down and talk about their love for surrealist novels, manga,
No. We're talking about romance, meet cutes, daring acts of love.
A new plan. Each week we convene online, despite being 2,500 miles away, to willingly have sibling spats about our taste in books.
Each week, we assign each other a book outside of our comfort zone, and then the next week, we
tear it to shreds.
No, we discuss what we liked, what we didn't like.
Usually that one.
Bronwyn. And then we give each other a new book so we can start all over again. We have a 2-week schedule so listeners can read along if they like.
We are part of the Pants Pending Studios Entertainment Network.
Find Trading Pages at tradingpages.pantspending.com or find us wherever you get your podcasts. Bronwyn, what are you doing?
Hold on. I'm texting Mom to apologize for our content this week. Again.
Oh, no.
Listening to The Social Hour.
They're not PC. So if occasional foul language turns you off, then you have all been warned. This is the calm before the storm.
I consider myself a patriot.
Get ready for The Social Hour.
This is The Social Hour. On today's show, former Spokane City Council president and activist Ben Stuckert. And now your host. He's hoping that Ben brought him the key to the city, Deese Kassian.
Malib Keen, everyone, welcome to the show. This is The Social Hour. I am Deese. Thank you for coming around for another episode. We got a special episode for you. Old friend of mine, former city council president and one-time mayoral candidate, Ben Stuckert, on the show today. I'm excited to have him in studio, be able to talk to him again. He's been on the show a couple times. He was an early adopter coming on the show and talking to us about the city, what's going on. And I've always been a big fan. I appreciate him always being willing to talk to us. And what he's done for the city, he is one of the guys that made me really fall in love with Spokane and see that it was worth fighting for. And there's a lot of things that we do need improvement on, but showing that there's a path for that. So he's got a couple things he's been working on. He's still active in the city, so I was glad to have him in and be able to chat with him, and hopefully soon we'll be able to get a chance to chat with him a little more as my campaign for mayor ramps up, and we can make this baby happen, right, Spokane? 2023, Deese is coming through for you to make Spokane a better place. What started off as a joke became a real thing. I got some ideas. We're moving. We're shaking. We're going to make this city better, but for now, we are going to chat with my old friend Ben Stuckert, talk about what he has going on and some ideas he thinks are important for the city of Spokane. So guys, check it out. As for me, as always, go to Deese County/calendar, check out all the dates. If you're listening to the show, as the day it comes out Thursday, I am in Missoula tonight at a winery that I don't know the name of, but it's in Missoula. Come check it out. It's on my calendar. Go to the calendar, guys. I don't have to do fucking everything for you. You guys do something for once. And as always, go to pantspending.com. Check out all the shows on the network. Patreon/pantspending. Donate. All that jazz. All right, guys. We're going to get into it. Talk to Ben here. Take a listen.
All right. And Ben, good to have you back on the show, man. It's good to see you. Thank you. Ben was one of the early legitimate guests I feel like we got on the show. And been very kind to be on Social Hour After Dark and many other things with this with the Social Hour and involved in the community. Was city councilor president, mayoral candidate, and now just doing stuff for the city and consulting, making it better every way you can.
Yeah, thanks for having me on. You had me on down at the Spokane Comedy Club too,
and yeah.
I think I flopped as a comedian, but
most do.
But
it's okay.
You let me talk for quite a while, even though I wasn't very funny. And you know, the Spokane Comedy Club, you just feel for, you know, all the artists in our community with COVID and what's going on.
Yeah.
And I don't know. I don't know if anybody. I'm just going to do my own plug for the Spokane Comedy Club.
Yeah.
Because it's one of the most professional places. And when you think Spokane and a comedy club, and then you go in there and how organized it is and how nice everybody is and the service is excellent and the comedians you guys brought in.
Right.
But then you just think during COVID, it all shut down and everybody's livelihood is affected.
Yeah.
So Deese, I just, like, as somebody who's been on your show before and gotten to know you and, you know, we've talked about the mayorship before and you running in a
yeah.
few years. And I hope you're okay and feel for all the comedians in our community.
Well, thanks. It's been a struggle. I've comedian friends across the country and it's been hard for everyone. I've just been trying to plug along, do what I can. I miss the live shows, but it'll come back one day.
I did look. You won Inlander Best Comedian in 2019, but you never got your sheet.
I still don't have my award.
No.
They actually interviewed me for something else that came out just this last Thursday in the Inlander, and talk about COVID, doing comedy, and then the idea of me running for mayor. And I'm like, oh, can you bring me my award when you come over to my house? You know, because they sent a guy over here to interview me and photographer. Still haven't seen the award.
Well, I was looking in my basement this afternoon because I won Best Local Politician
yeah.
in 2017 and 2018, and I don't think I kept them. I think they might not have
made it.
Yeah,
they might not have
made it out of the office.
That's all right. You know, I don't know what I would have done with it. I've got this thing that somebody framed for me. This is bad pod. I'm pointing something at my wall. But I only kept that because a friend made that for me. Otherwise, like, whatever. I don't, you know, it doesn't matter. But we're all doing what we can for Spokane. It seems like you've been busier since you stopped running, you know, stop being in the political forum directly in Spokane.
Yeah, I'm a part-time director of the Low Income Housing Consortium, which represents all the nonprofits and for-profit builders of low-income housing in Spokane. And, you know, we have a housing crisis, so I've stayed really busy with that. I've been doing a little work on fluoride, probably about 15 to 20 hours a week lately, really looking at how we can fluoridate our water. So between those two things and then a couple developers have me trying to help with their projects, I feel like I bug city council now more than when I was on the council.
When you were there throwing it down every week. I don't know what order you want to talk, but let's do, I'm really curious about this fluoride thing, because fluoride I feel like is a very polarizing topic. So you're trying to find ways to fluoridate the water in Spokane.
Yeah, so fluoridation is a fascinating subject. And
right.
So about 100 years ago, they noticed that there weren't as many cavities in Colorado Springs,
mm-hmm.
Colorado. And after testing, they figured out that there was a mineral in their water that was naturally occurring, which was fluoride. And some of them had fluorosis because there was too much in the water.
Sure.
But they didn't have the cavities. And so that started this movement where now 75% of the people in the United States have fluoridated water. And if you compare the kids in our community without fluoride, about 25% more cavities in Spokane than cities of the same size. And the studies show that it's due to fluoride. But there's been 65,000 studies done on fluoride.
Yeah.
And
wow,
the scientific consensus is it's good if you do it at the right level. if you don't have enough, it doesn't do anything. And if you have too much, it does bad things.
Right.
But the Center for Disease Control has said it's 0.7 milligrams per liter of water in your water. And they've said that was one of the top 10 public health interventions of the 20th century. But because it's a foreign substance that you're adding to the water, it gets complicated. And there have been studies that people have invalidated that show that it does really awful things.
Yeah.
And then, you know, people call like to call it a toxic chemical instead of the naturally occurring mineral that it is. So it gets really complicated. And when I was on the public health board, we had a group of about four or five community members that would come to every single public health meeting and testify about how awful fluoride was. And right now we're trying to get the city council because COVID's really like closed down our schools. And one of one of the most impactful interventions in our community that's done is through this group called Tooth Savers. And they go in and do sealants on kids' teeth, but they only can do it during school hours. So now kids don't even have the interventions they did before COVID. And then you see the impacts on our communities of color are impacted further by that, where they're impacted by childcare, by stay-at-home orders, the economic inequalities. Everything's compounded during COVID. And we're having this community-wide conversation about public health and whether to listen to public health or not. And so council is on their own, really. We were working on it earlier this year, trying to get them to put it on the ballot and working behind the scenes. And we did a lot of education, and council on their own has really listened to the community over the last year and said, we want to get this done and pass it councilmatically. So, you know, some of the council members still communicate with me, and they forwarded a 200-page treatise on how fluoride is bad for horses.
Yeah.
And you're like, I don't even know what to, like, they were like, can you help me? Help me talk through this. And I'm like,
how many horses are in our constituents here? Well, the CDC also said we should wear masks. So how do I get the fluoride through my mask?
Just drink water. Well, you can't get it if it's not in your water.
So here's a question for people who may oppose this, you know, the idea of fluoride, because there is that, a lot of people claim it, there's whatever for your bad for your brain. It actually creates a calcium around certain glands in your brain, which things, et cetera, that people have, you know, whether there's validity to that, I don't know. Has there been discussion of, instead of putting in the municipal water system, having some other sort of citywide option that distributes it to people regularly as opposed to through drinking water? And also, how do we encourage people to start drinking? What if we put it in Mountain Dew instead? I feel like it'd get to more people then.
It might get to it more in the Mountain Dew.
Yeah.
But really what studies have shown is if you don't put it in the water that people are drinking regularly, they just don't take it and use it.
Okay.
And there's a problem with access for low-income individuals. But okay. One of the things we found a community in Florida had done, and it was controversial, and the community was pretty split on it. So when they fluoridated their water, you know, we get our water from the aquifer, and it comes up at these pumping stations.
Right.
And so we'll have a clean pump that comes up from the pumping stations that anybody can go and get as much water as they want, and anytime they want, 24 hours a day, and get as much water as they want that doesn't have the fluoride in it. So it gives them an option. And we've really been talking to community members. So if you said, I'm not going to drink water from my tap, I want another source, but I'm paying a water fee to live in this city,
sure,
then you can go to this pumping station and get as much water as you want anytime.
So you still have an option. You're not stuck with only fluoride. Okay. Yep. So that is a good alternative, at least for people who are very concerned. It's not like the CDC forcing everyone to take the coronavirus vaccine or something. Which may or may not happen.
I don't think they'll force everybody to take it, but
sure.
But if enough people don't take the vaccine when it does come out,
a whole other. God, who knows there? The fluoride, and how much pushback you getting from locally from the city on something like this?
Oh, there's a council member that is adamantly opposed because it's forcing it on people that may not want it. But right now, there's some city staff that I think probably question it, just like, it's a pretty. When it went to the ballot in 2000, fluoride failed by less than a percentage point.
Okay.
Now, lately, we've seen some polling that shows that it's probably supported by about 55%, opposed by a little over 30%, and then there's always that 18 to 20% that are just like, I don't know.
Whatever.
I have no idea about that issue, and I don't care. So I think there's a majority of Spokane that does support fluoridating the water.
Yeah.
But really, if they're going to be the minority when you hear the voices, because the people that are concerned about something in their water are going to be much louder and much more concerned. And then there are these nationwide groups that are, well, they have millions and millions of dollars, and I can't figure out who's funding them, and I don't understand it. But
yeah,
some of the letters council, you know, are getting are, you know, 20-page documents.
Big Dasani.
Yeah.
Big Dasani's funding this.
Yeah, well, then you look up the companies, and, you know, there are these nonprofits that are funding it, and they have millions and millions of dollars to oppose fluoride. But I think right now, especially with COVID and with our kids, and we know the data on decreasing cavities,
we really,
Spokane's a little behind the curve, and it's about time to get there.
What are some of the cities out there that do have fluoride in the water? What percentage of cities are using fluoride in their water regularly, and what are some of the notable ones, I guess? Or
Seattle, Tacoma, Boise, Cheney. Outside of us.
Okay.
Fluoridates their water. They fluoridated it in 1974.
How are the scores at Eastern? Have they been good since then?
You can actually look at the data from kids that grow up in Cheney versus kids that grow up in Spokane, and there's a disparity on cavities.
Sure. Okay.
And if we really want to get down to like the nitty gritty, somebody with bad teeth is going to have a harder time finding a job.
Sure.
Like,
people
judge on appearance, and we may all say we don't judge on appearance, but somebody shows up for a job interview with good teeth, and then somebody shows up with a bunch of cavities and bad teeth.
Right.
They're at a disadvantage. So we're putting our whole town at a disadvantage.
So when does this go to a vote?
I'm not sure. I think city council hopefully will be voting on this sometime in the next couple months.
Okay.
I think they're having another presentation. There's going to be a public forum, I think, in the end of August through Zoom. But I think the city will be hosting it so that they get to hear from all different sides and everybody's opinion. My understanding that forum is going to be like the 26th, 27th, or 28th of August. And I'll make sure and put it on my Facebook page.
Where are these pumps, you say, where people would be able to go and gain access 24 hours a day? I mean, obviously it's not an obstacle that's impossible, but I would imagine there's going to be some complaints of, well, it's coming out of my faucet, I have to go, you know, middle of the winter, I have to go travel this pump and I'm pumping, et cetera, that could be an obstacle.
Yeah, so there's 6 pumping stations around the city, and like there's one in East Central, there's one right near West Central. So the people that have transportation issues and will probably be close to one where they can go get it.
Yeah.
And I've made it clear that I think there should be multiple pumping stations so that you're not having to drive all the way across town in order to get that water.
Are these things that exist already, or we would be implementing into the city?
No, well, the pumping stations exist. It's where we pull all the water up.
Where you already
are. So you could just build a tap in directly into that pumping station without the fluoridation.
I see. You're just adding on to something that does already exist then. Okay.
Yeah, there is. There's about a $4 million cost to implement it. But right now, so far, there's a group called Smile Spokane, and they've raised, I think, $3.5 million out of the $4 million for the capital cost. And the city has said, if you want to move forward, and if this is going to move forward, you have to raise the full $4 million so that it doesn't come from the public at all.
Right.
All that's private foundations saying, okay, we believe in this. And all the health, and you know, like there's Empire Health Foundation in town. There's a group called Better Health Together. There's Providence. There's Multicare.
Every dentist in town is probably making sure this doesn't go through. They're like, we want these people to.
Which is surprising. You'd think they'd be opposed to it.
Yeah.
But like 90% of the dentists are in favor of it and have signed the letter of support. And I think that kind of goes to show that they're not just in dentistry because you make a great living being a dentist, but they actually care about teeth. And I think you talk to some of them personally and talk to them, and they are for it because they're tired of little kids coming in with cavities when it just shouldn't be happening.
Yeah. So now you say it talks about $4 million to, and that is for implementing the system. Does that include the cost of fluoridating the water, or is that an additional cost each year, I assume?
I think there's some annual costs, and I haven't been involved in the discussions of the annual costs. But the upfront cost to fluoridate the water, set up that system mm-hmm. right away, is $4 million, and that won't be paid for by the taxpayers.
And then after that, the cost of annually is kind of question mark at this yep. point, I assume. Okay. All right. Well, we will keep an eye out for that. We'll keep an eye. The city council still meets every Monday at 6. Is that right?
Yep.
Where people can get information on that. And I do encourage people to go and either watch them or check them out live. I've personally been getting more active in that because of what I'm doing. But now you said there's some other things you're working on too. What else is the homeless or housing levy?
Yeah, and so housing and let's look at our housing system in general, and there's sure. all sorts of issues. We know if anybody's listening here in rents, they know that rents have risen, or if they've tried to buy a house lately, house
nuts.
Costs are absolutely insane. Like houses on my block have doubled in the last 3 years since we bought our house.
Oh, yeah.
It's just shocking, but you couldn't afford my paycheck hasn't doubled in the last, but rent. And I remember in the 1980s, market rate apartments were cheap enough that with a couple of roommates, you could get a big house.
Right.
And when I was young, making minimum wage, and that's just not the case now. And we've really we were lucky for a long time that we had such low rents, but that's no longer the case. And we didn't keep up locally with building affordable low-income housing.
Sure.
And so in a city, you have all these market rate houses, which we've screwed up too. We don't have enough apartments for people, and that's why there's a lack of available apartments. And so that's why rents rise, because we've got too low a vacancy rate. But in affordable housing, I was talking to there's a nonprofit in town called Spokane Housing Ventures.
So real quickly, Ben, when you say affordable housing, do you mean building apartments or actual houses?
Both. Okay. I think we need to continually talk about affordable apartments and affordable housing.
Yes.
Because if we continue to just say we're going to put low-income apartments up and don't address low-income houses where people can buy in and are subsidized to get ownership, then people aren't building wealth.
Because
home ownership is the clearest, quickest way to build personal wealth and to get out of the cycle of poverty is to own your home and have that wealth and be able to transfer that.
Well, yeah, some stability and some, it's an actual mostly appreciating asset, especially in our area. So.
Absolutely. And so we got to talk about both houses and we got to talk about apartments. But in a typical large city, and we got to continually talk about, we're not some small little tiny town.
Right.
We're an urban center, which is why we see a lot of problems that smaller towns don't see, because we are the population center that people are attracted to.
Yeah.
But a large city often has about 18 to 20% of their housing is not market rate, it's subsidized. So it could be subsidized one of two ways. You subsidize the building of it, and then you accept vouchers, or you just have vouchers and accept low-income vouchers and you accept low-income clients at a discounted rate. And so you might have an old apartment complex that somebody buys and turns into a low apartment. But we haven't built a single unit for seniors, for low-income seniors in over 5 years. We haven't built a single apartment or house for the working class, because if you make minimum wage, you are actually at 60 to 80% of the average median income, and you qualify for low-income housing.
Oh,
if you
make
minimum wage, you qualify for low-income housing.
And that's a lot
housing.
Of people in Spokane, especially
Absolutely.
Now.
Absolutely. And so we just haven't built those units. So when I say like a typical city has 18 to 20% of the apartments in town are low-income, we only have about 11% of our apartments. And that was because for so long – we didn't have a problem because those market rate regular apartments were so low rent.
Yeah.
But we're behind the schedule. And so what we see is Spokane Housing Ventures today, I was on the phone and I was like, how long is your wait list? Because they have 800 apartments in Spokane that are low income. Their wait list is over 3 years. So say I lose my job and I'm homeless and I'm living at a shelter downtown.
Right. Which is going away.
And I do everything right. I fill out all the right paperwork. I go through all the hoops. And I end up on a waiting list for housing. It can be up to 3 years for an individual in Spokane right now to get into those low-income apartments.
That's crazy.
That is, how are you? And think about if you're living in a shelter and it's 3 years. How are you supposed to do resumes? How are you supposed to wash and dry your clothes?
Right.
And then go to an interview, much less get transportation. Like, housing is this base need that we all have. And if we don't have enough apartments, and if the wait lists are 3 years long, how are we going to get help people get out of the situation?
Yeah, those 3 years are crippling. And that's that's one of the things that actually I really appreciate about, you know, everything you did in the city council and running for mayor, is that you viewed Spokane as a big city. And what people don't realize is, I mean, we are the second biggest city in Washington State, and we're growing exponentially. And people want to treat us like the small, quaint town they grew up in. It's like, I understand that want, but it's not practical anymore. We're growing and we need to keep up with it. They've bottlenecked it to a point where we're going to get so far behind the eight ball, there's no catching up. I mean, we're at a pinnacle moment where it's like, we need to either step on the accelerator greatly, or we're going to be so far behind, it's going to be crippling to the entire city.
Yeah. And we need to build more low income apartments, and council's going to have an opportunity this fall to vote on a housing levy.
What does that mean for the council and the people then?
Well, it means for the people, you'd probably be paying, instead of an 8.9% sales tax, you'd be paying a 9% sales tax. So for every $10 you spent, you'd spend an extra penny.
Yeah.
Okay. It cost you, the average citizen, it's going to cost them $16 a year. But it'll be a raise of taxes. But that $6 million will go into building an additional 100 units of low-income housing a year. That's not being built right now, and we're falling behind. But we need to, like, in the larger conversation, is there's not enough market rate housing. So say I'm 25 and single, I've graduated from SFCC with my 2-year degree, and I'm cooking at night, or I'm bartending, and I want to live in an apartment, but I want to live near, say, Monroe Street.
Yeah.
Monroe is surrounded by single family houses. If I wanted to go live in the Perry Street neighborhood, there are no apartments right along Perry Street.
Right.
It's all surrounded by single family homes. And then you know what those single family homeowners do is complain about people parking in front of their house.
Yeah.
Like, you're like, oh my God, that's why you surround business districts with apartments and density. And then it helps the business district, because then you have people that can walk to those businesses. Because if we think about, and that's why downtown is, it peaks and valleys, and I've noticed that my whole life, that you'll have upgrades of downtown. You'll see all these great things happening, and then it goes down into a valley again. And we're continually peaking and valleying because we don't have enough people that live downtown to support all those businesses. You want people to be able to walk to where they shop. And unless we have enough people living near these businesses, you see things plateau. And we saw this huge increase for 15 years in Perry Street, where they improved the street environment, new businesses opened, but new businesses are not opening on Perry Street, and you actually have vacant businesses now. Yeah. It's plateaued. And it's plateaued because the way we've set up our town is that people have to drive to Perry Street to hang out, or they have to drive to go over to Monroe, because there just aren't enough people that live near there
to support it. Yeah.
And so we've got to rethink our... Jim Frank, who developed Kendall Yards, always discusses it as, we have a suburban mindset when we need to have an urban mindset.
Absolutely, yeah.
But it's really hard, because you have, every time somebody tries to build an apartment building in a single family neighborhood, they fight it tooth and nail because they want things to stay exactly the same.
Sure.
And we're just not there anymore. We're not going to survive if we stay exactly the same. So I spend days in these meetings where, you know, I'm representing low-income housing providers, but I have a couple developers that I'm working with trying to get housing projects up in market rate housing done. And you sit in these meetings and I just want to scream and go run and like work at McDonald's, because it's so frustrating.
Well, where would you say, like, low-income housing, low-income, let's talk apartments first. Because I think part of it is, where these apartments end up. Like, personally speaking, I think the low income apartments that they did at the Red Path was detrimental to the progress of downtown. So I think it's important of where and how you consider these. Although low income, the Red Path ones are a little bit, I think maybe even a notch below what I call low income housing or apartments. So, like, when you say low income apartments, where are we talking about them landing?
Well, so take, for example, out on Sprague, right across, it's One South Medelia is a really good example of a project that helped improve the neighborhood. As we spent money on improving Sprague,
yeah,
and we spent about $18 million. We didn't want the, and you never want a neighborhood to gentrify, right? You don't want everybody that lives there to abandon the neighborhood and displace the people that are currently there that grew up there. But you want to improve our neighborhoods. And so you somehow, and we incentivized, we gave extra points if they built low-income housing where we were rebuilding it. And so what you saw was a rise in property values, but two new projects along Sprague, the Sprague Terrace, Union Terrace project, and the Community Frameworks built the One South Medelia. And those projects have really kept that neighborhood mixed income. So even as you improve the neighborhood, you ensure it's mixed income. Because right. one of my biggest frustrations, and you can look at old maps of Spokane where they actually, you know, they call it redlining, where certain people can't live. And it's part of our racist structure in the past, is where we had actual neighborhoods on a map that were redlined out and said nobody from a community of color can live in those neighborhoods.
Yeah.
Well, if you look at the map of where communities of color live now, it's everywhere that wasn't redlined then. Like, they don't still live in those neighborhoods.
Right.
And so you have a tension in a city where all the rich people live in a certain area on the South Hill and they don't want apartments in their neighborhood.
Yeah.
But we don't want to concentrate everything in a certain area. Like, you don't want all your low income housing in one 4-block square radius.
Right, right.
Because then that just feeds off of itself and people can't get out of the situation. So you need to spread it out, and we need to figure out how to be, because it's really easy to demonize somebody if you don't know them.
Yeah.
And if you live in the heart of the South Hill and grew up there and then settled there, spent your whole life in a million-dollar mansion on Rockwood Boulevard and have never ridden the bus, you don't know anything different other than the rich people you grew up with and went to Hutton with.
Sure.
And so then
it's all the same.
Then
yeah.
to you drive through downtown, some guy on the street asking for money, you just discount him completely because you've never had to deal with somebody that's poor.
Yeah.
And so we really, my firm belief is we need, in pockets across the city, we need mixed income neighborhoods where everybody's interacting. And it'd be even better, there's some apartments downtown have certain low income units, and then some of the other units are market rate.
Right.
And that's even better when you're interacting with your neighbors constantly and you're from different economic viewpoints, just because you get to know, because once you get to know somebody, it's a lot harder to demonize them.
Well, it also creates more of a cohesive community instead of a separation, basically a financial separation between people, which can create tension and create problems. Whereas if you have just one cohesive community, it's easier to maintain. So real quickly, I know you kind of segueing, because what you mentioned from someone from the South Hill coming downtown, you know, seeing whether it's a low income or a homeless person downtown and kind of being put off by that. Let's talk about homelessness in Spokane real quick, which is a growing problem, especially in downtown. Something that you worked with a lot while you were on the council. What's your thoughts on how that's, I don't want to even use the word progressed.
I think we've done a really poor job of, and this is another occurrence of where the federal government used to fund our shelter system. Mm-hmm. And up until 2015, the city didn't put any money that we had locally into our shelters.
Yeah.
Other than really minimal. And that's grown over time, but not enough, because the federal dollars, and the feds made a choice at one point and said, okay, we're going to focus on really funding getting people out of homeless shelters and funding the permanent supportive housing, which is good. But instead of funding shelters as a stopgap and funding permanent supportive housing, they just cut their shelter funding. And so what you get then is an unfunded shelter system. And then the city's coming in with whatever money they can, but it's not enough.
Yeah.
And then you have a system where there's, we talked about this group earlier, but Jules Helping Hands, and they really do a lot of outreach in our community. And I was reading online the other day, they did, I think, outreach to over 400 people in one day. So those are people that aren't in our shelter system that are living by the river. And then I don't believe in our, you know, if you have, say, 700 shelter beds in your community for emergency shelter, but you know there's 1,200 homeless people on the yearly count, what are you saying about those 400 people? Are they expendable?
I think our bed count's much less than that now, even.
Well, I think the bed count went down to 580 during COVID because they had to physically distance the beds by 6 feet. So you may have as many shelter beds as you do people living on the street, or more people on the street, that no matter what there's just more people than there are beds.
Yeah.
And so I've always argued you need more affordable housing, which is what we talked about earlier. We need more market rate housing and apartments, so we drive the rents down. We need to focus on economic development and revitalization of our neighborhoods, but you also need enough shelter beds, and you need to be somehow, and this is where Hope House, which is run by Volunteers of America, they do a really good job. They're a single woman shelter, and they offer social services inside the emergency shelter.
Okay.
And they offer caseworkers for the women that are staying there. And they see within a 90-day period, 60% of the women that stay at Hope House move into transitional or permanent housing. And so somehow we've got to crack that nut and spend the money up front so that if somebody's in a shelter, they are receiving services and not just a bed and a bowl of food.
Yeah.
They're actually getting the help they need. Because once you're homeless, it's really, really hard to go and find those services somewhere. And
especially now, you don't have the library, you don't have access to internet or access to phone call. How do you even contact or look up any services?
The city did a real disservice. HUD had us open a resource center a couple years ago. It's way outside of downtown. So if you're homeless downtown, they won't give bus passes to the homeless folks downtown to get to the resource center. They put a lot of services out there. But I really believe you get somewhere when you bring the services to where the people are, and you can make a quicker, better, more impactful difference. And, you know, I guess I lost the election, so my ideas weren't the most popular, but I think
Trump also won the presidential election, so don't feel too bad.
But I just feel bad that the argument became about homeless people, and we didn't try to. The conversation got away from trying to understand people as humans and as members of our community. Yeah. And there was a lot of demonization that happened. And I tried, but I obviously failed to communicate well that we've got to take care of each other. And it's part of being in a community is, and it's not just giving somebody something, but it's how do we also help them?
Well, I think a big thing kind of, you know, I've been trying to outline kind of my working with the homeless outreach and kind of my goals moving forward as running for mayor is, you know, in 2023 is I want to, I've been trying to put together this idea of how we help those people, because it is to me also it's looked at as a, more as a criminal thing, where I think it should be looked at as a mental health issue. I think that's greatly important. And also we need to find a kind of put these people on a path of getting them back into a sense of normalcy, because most people crave that. They want that. And if they have some sort of reason to be getting up in the morning, some sort of responsibility, they're working, that makes them feel better about themselves. They're less likely, the recidivism rate goes down, the relapse rate goes down. And some sort of incremental steps of programs where, yes, we have warming shelters, we get them food. I am a proponent of defunding the police and moving some of those funds to social workers who can work hands on with these people and more qualified, as opposed to police officers who are, again, just looking at them as a criminal offense, you know, just want to throw them in jail for a night. And slowly moving these into people into permanent housing. The idea of I've been looking at the idea of cost of tiny homes and what that would look like, and getting these people jobs with portion of their income going towards subsidizing the housing and things like that. There's a lot of things we think Spokane could do.
Absolutely. You just need the willpower at the top to get it done.
That, that said like a man who's been there and experienced what that, how that happened.
That's great. Well, thanks for having me on. And,
yeah.
If you want to talk again in a little while and, maybe I could interview you on your own podcast about your mayoral run and we could dig into some of this stuff.
I would love to do that. I definitely, at some point, definitely would love to chat with you more about it and see what we can do, because I want to, as you do and still are, continue to make Spokane a better place and make it the place we all want it to be.
And so. I just can't wait until I can come see you down at the Spokane Comedy Club.
Hopefully soon. All right, guys. Ben, thank you very much for being here, guys. As for me, go to Dee's Comedy/calendar. Like I said, some dates coming back in other states. So for Social Hour, I've been Dee's, and for Ben, thank you very much, guys, and we will see you next week.